Sirs, start your engines!
Hit the pace car! What for? Because you hit every other damn thing out there, I want you to be perfect!
When I'm driving, I got a guy on the radio who talks to me. You can see him. He talks to me.
He didn't slam you, he didn't bump you, he didn't nudge you, he rubbed you. And rubbing's son is racing.
Good evening, race fans. Welcome to the Hoobazoo Radio Network, and welcome to the Drafting the Circuits radio program. My name is Frank Santoroski. I'll be your host for the next hour as we talk over this past week in racing and preview next week. Joining me in the studio tonight is my good friend Gray Warren, Seth Eggert, and Richard Uden. Fellas, how we doing tonight?
Terrific.
Doing good.
Good, thank you.
All right, great to have you all here. Like I always say, it's the highlight of my week when I get to talk to you all. But so let's knock out the headlines real quick. Big winners of the week, Kyle Busch down in Bristol and Takuma Sato down in Barber Motorsports Park. So pretty good weekend of racing. Let's start with Bristol. We had I think it was a better Bristol race than we've seen recently. Kyle Busch came back from some adversity to eventually take that win. I believe that's his eighth win at Bristol overall.
Correct.
Yeah. So good on him. So, Gray, Seth, let's talk about Bristol.
Well, they put the traction compound back down again, as they have been for the past 3 or 4 years, but this time they only did it in about 4 wide strip in the turns. And they used what they called a 50-50 solution. And it actually stayed throughout the entire race. In the past, it's worn off, and the racing, as it wore off, got worse. And this time, you actually had multiple grooves. You had Kyle Busch primarily on the bottom. Kurt Busch, who almost ran his brother down in the final laps after starting 27th, running the high groove. You had Chase Elliott starting from the pole, leading about the first 40 or so laps before the accordion effect sent him spinning around. And he ran 459 laps without power steering at Bristol.
Yeah, and that in itself is not impressive, not unprecedented, but still is quite a job there to wrestle a car for that many laps at Bristol without power steering.
And he finished on the lead lap somehow, too. Yeah. You had a couple of accordion-like incidents throughout the race. Blaney, Newman, and Chase, for example. You had, at the beginning of the race, when I believe it was Matt Tift who spun, Corey LaJoie ran into Chase Elliott. It was just an odd race, especially at the beginning. Ty Dillon won the first stage, which if anyone had Ty Dillon winning a stage at a non-super speedway track, please go and buy a lottery ticket. That was just pretty amazing.
Well,
there.
You know, that's a deal where everybody comes to pit road before the end of the stage, so they don't have to come back and they actually gain track position when the green flag flies after the stage. So, but, yeah, and he and Bowyer stayed out and raced for the stage win.
Yeah, but the fact that he was able to hold Bowyer off was actually impressive, especially for that team. Otherwise, there was a couple of fun moments throughout the race and post-race. You had a interesting joking exchange between both Ryan Newman and Ryan Blaney after the race. Blaney had put Newman into the wall trying to defend for position, and Newman came over joking with him and saying, if you're going to listen to your spotter, why are you ignoring your mirror?
Yeah. That is funny.
And the only downside to the race, the very end, the last green flag run, We actually got shorted two laps because Brad Keselowski, somewhere in the team communication, never got the message of where he was supposed to line back up. And NASCAR extended the caution by two laps trying to get him into position. And they ended up black flagging him for ignoring NASCAR directives.
Yeah,
that's certainly interesting, yeah. But yeah, we've seen that before in the past where somebody's just kind of not sure where to line up and whatnot. But yeah, it's a shame that it took two laps off the race.
But, you know, it was a very good, very highly competitive race. You know, there were cars that were coming and going. Some cars were better on the long run. Some cars better on the short run. You had Ryan Blaney. I believe he ended up leading the most laps. His car was really good. You had different guys run up near the front at various times. Clint Bowyer had a really good car. Looked poised to pick up his first win of the season at one time before he had some issues. But and then, of course, what do you say about Kyle Busch? I mean, gets spun on the first lap. Cars basically has some cosmetic damage. It really didn't hurt it too bad. The deck lid was on straight and the spoiler was in its proper position. So he was able to soldier on and ends up winning the race.
Good
smart move at the end of the race. He chose not to come down pit road. And was able to hold off the guys for about the final 15 laps of the race, and another tremendous performance by the guy. I mean, you know, I think we're treated each week that we watch this guy because he is definitely, like Darrell Waltrip said, he is the show. He puts on a show every week. You know, and you get your money's worth. You love him or hate him, the guy gets in that race car and he gives it 100%.
And before we get to DW, who announced this is his final season calling races, just want to mention, speaking of the first lap, Eric Almirola, he had contact with William Byron, ended up going into the wall.
Mm-hmm.
He came down the pit road, and as he left his pit box, he left with equipment. The jack was still underneath the car. The team, instead of having him come all the way back around, had him go to the garage area. He was still on the damaged vehicle policy, and once he entered the garage, he was out of the race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Granted, they argued with NASCAR saying it was a mechanical issue because of the jack. Meanwhile, they also told reporters at the track that they had enough steering damage that they would not have been able to complete a lap.
Yeah.
So what's the clear cut definition of the rule? I mean, if you go to the garage, are you done?
If you're involved in an accident where you hit the wall or you hit another car and you go to the garage without getting a green flag lap at minimum speed, then you're out. If you go to the garage for a mechanical issue, like Ricky Stenhouse did, you can come back.
Yeah. And then if you go to pit road to fix, to repair damage, you're under a clock. And if you can't repair the damage in said time, which I believe is
6 minutes.
Yeah, something like that, you have to retire the car as well. So,
all right. So basically their argument was that it was a mechanical issue, although mm-hmm. it can kind of be seen differently.
Well,
because it was more of an equipment issue or a, you know, boneheaded move on pit road.
It was more the boneheaded move on pit road led to them going to the garage instead of fixing it on pit road.
Well, otherwise, what you're going to have is every time somebody gets damaged, they're going to drop the car for the jack and break something so they can take it to the garage to fix it.
Yeah.
And one other point on the damage clock there is, you have 6 minutes to repair the car, but that's a cumulative 6 minutes. So if you're under caution, you want to avoid going a lap down, you can, you know, do 30 seconds of repair, go back out, come around again, do 30 seconds of repair. And it also, that 6 minutes resets once you get back up to a predetermined speed that NASCAR declares at the start of the race.
And you cannot add sheet metal to the car at any track other than Daytona and Talladega. The only reason why they allow you to add sheet metal to the car at those two tracks is because of sheer speed if you spin to keep the car on the ground.
Yeah.
It's more of a safety. Well,
that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was, I thought it was a good race. Very disappointed in the crowd that was there. It was shocking to see the turns weren't even open on either end of the track, and sparsely, on both the front stretch and back stretch. And that was really somewhat concerning, because, you know, it wasn't too many years ago that track was the hottest ticket in the sport, and hard to get in. It was tough to get, but I think there's more at work here than people being just dissatisfied with NASCAR, because if they didn't like that show, they don't like racing. That's it in a nutshell. But I think basically there was other talk during the course of the weekend. I think you had several drivers expressing their displeasure at some of the hotels.
Clint Boyer was one of the most vocal. Jeb Burton as well.
Yeah, and forcing their displeasure at the hotels, price gouging on hotels.
Well,
and
go ahead. That is a factor, regardless. I mean, whether or not NASCAR can do anything about it, in the past. To my knowledge, NASCAR and the tracks have tried to work with the hotels.
But it's just a small portion of it, because by and large, a lot of fans come the day of, they drive up. But when you look at, you know, the price of fuel to go, and then you've got parking cost, concession cost, and ticket cost, it's cha-ching, everything. It gradually builds, and let's face it, fans don't have the disposable income that they once had, and I'm not going to say that's the whole picture, but that's by and large that's a big part that we're seeing at not only Bristol but a lot of other tracks.
There's definitely a lot of other tracks with a lot of empty seats, and I really would like to have a conversation about the future of the schedule. Okay, and we were talking about it a little bit, where some of these tracks don't need two dates, right?
Yeah.
With the, I don't want to say the fan interest is waning, but the amount of fans are definitely not coming to the track. Is it maybe a smarter move to give everybody one race and just bank on that one?
Well, you go back.
Go ahead.
Well, you go back to the thing where the fans, it's tough. The fans have to choose. They can't go to, economically, they can't go to as many races as they do. So a lot of your fans now at Bristol, they may skip the spring race, because typically the spring race weather comes into play and has come into play the last several years. It's cooler. You can have some wet weather, things like that. So they choose to say, okay, we're gonna put all our eggs in the fall race, and they'll go to the night,
which is the night race,
right? And I bet you we will see a huge contrast between the crowds at the spring race and the fall race. I'm sure Bristol will rebound, in the spectator department for that spring race.
Right, but my point is, do we need to maybe just have one race?
No.
It depends on the track.
Yeah, it depends on the track.
So here's, can I raise a point real quick on this one? Sorry. I'm sure that a lot of these tracks do all of their, market research and analysis of people that come through the gate and all this sort of stuff. I wonder what percentage of people double dip throughout the season. If you get 20,000 people at, say, the Dover spring race, and then 20,000 people at Dover fall race, or however the schedule falls there, is it 20,000 unique people? So if you only have one race, are you suddenly going to get 40,000 there? Or is it, 15 of those 20,000 go to both races? Maybe that's what's happened here. Maybe these, the tracks have gone out and done their analysis and said, well, look, hey, if you take us down to one race, we're not going to suddenly get the same amount of money coming in as having two.
Well,
so they need to have two to make it justifiable.
Or they need to diversify. I mean, let's look at Charlotte, for example.
Sure.
A, they made their fall race unique with the Roval. But on top of that, they have a music festival. They have the auto fair. They have the end of year Christmas essentially party that they do. I mean, they have a
Christmas light show.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
But they do so much that isn't purely just racing. I mean, during the summer, every Tuesday night, they have the Summer Shootout Series. And on top of that, they do other stuff as well. Believe this year they're going to have the USAC Quarter Midgets run a shorter version of the Roval, and they're even talking about having IMSA come and run the Roval. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and that's you know, using the facility 365 days a year, and that's how it turns money over. Some tracks are better suited to do that. Charlotte is one of them. Another track that's well suited is Sonoma. Sonoma has a lot of events at their racetrack. You don't, obviously here on the East Coast, we don't hear about a lot of them, but I have friends that are in management at that track, and they have events out there all year long with festivals and shows and things like that.
And same with Vegas.
That continue. Some tracks, when you get up in the Northeast, obviously with weather and things like that, they aren't able to do the same thing. But then again, too, you get to a point of, you know, things become oversaturated. And this has been the argument for years of why Rockingham is no longer on the schedule, because it was less than 60 miles as the crow flies from Darlington. And you had four races a year within that 60 mile or so radius. And people that came in, drove in for that, they had, you know, as the economy changed, people had to start making choices. I know when I was in high school and in college, we went to all four every year. Tickets weren't, you know, to where the point where you couldn't afford them. So we went to both Rockingham races every year. We went to both Darlington races every year, probably both Martinsville races every year. And the like. But nowadays, you know, it's a little bit different, a little bit more financial commitment to do all these. You know, I think to your point, Frank, talking about taking races from some of these facilities, some of them can't survive without the two shows. But obviously, how much longer are they going to survive with it dwindling the way it is? So basically, you're going to have to kind of retool a little bit and let's pull back a little bit and make this oddity is not the word I'm looking for, but make it more of a unique.
Unique
event rather than
at Pocono next year doing a doubleheader.
Right. So, you know, and that's just societal changes too. You know, we can't, you know, the demographic in racing is not the same as it was in the 60s and 70s and 80s and even the 90s. It's changing, and the sports has got to change with that demographic to a degree. And that's what we're going to probably see with the schedule changes and some of the other things coming.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was having a conversation with some friends the other day, and we were talking about rock music concerts, right? And how it seems like just in general, the price of entertainment,
mm-hmm.
whether it be going to a baseball game, going to a NASCAR race, or going to see your favorite rock band in concert, has like the prices have skyrocketed compared to the, you know, level of inflation.
Right.
I mean, when I used to go to a rock concert, it was $9.50 to sit in the uppers, $12 to sit on the floor. Now, if you can get a concert ticket that's less than $200, hey, you know, you're doing well. So,
right.
But the same thing with racing. But then, like, you know, to your point, Seth, with the hotels. I mean, you had Seth shared with the rest of us here a hotel bill from Bristol for the weekend.
From last year, yeah.
$1,100.
Yeah.
$1,100.
That's how much it cost me to
stay in a hotel.
Yeah. Frank,
last year.
To your point about the rock concerts, I had a thing today. The Eagles are going to be at, I think, the MGM Grand in Vegas later this month or next month.
tickets start at 180. Start at 180.
You have to sit in the very back or in the very top.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know,
but we digress here. But I do want to just make the point that I think NASCAR has done the right thing with the show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think some of what drove folks away from Bristol was after they configured the track and whatnot, the show was not as good as it used to be.
It did hurt the competition because.
Bristol used to be an incredible race, but I think what they showed us this weekend is a good step in the right direction to get fans back in the stands there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've seen good races all year long. I think we've seen some really good competition at the races so far this year. I think basically NASCAR's just got to stay the course. And keep, you know, letting, okay, you know, fans look at it and say, okay, yeah, this is a good show, and it's going to spread, you know, by word of mouth. And you know, let's face it, haters are going to hate, you know, and that's always going to be the case. But they just got to keep staying the course and keep putting on a good trying to put on the best show they can on Sundays.
Absolutely. So now, Seth. I want to backtrack to something you mentioned earlier. Darrell Waltrip, who's been in the broadcast booth for 19 years now, has announced that he's going to step away after Fox wraps up their midseason before they turn the coverage over to NBC. So, Darrell Waltrip.
Yeah, he will be retiring after the Sonoma race this year. He might come back as, say, an analyst on Race Hub, or might do a little radio or something along those lines. He hasn't completely decided what he's going to do after retiring from being the broadcaster. That being said, in recent years, he's become somewhat of a divisive figure as far as a broadcaster is concerned. There are fans that like him. There are fans that don't like him. I'll be honest, there's been moments where I've questioned certain things privately with you guys. But the point is, this rumblings about this started earlier this season. And it was his announcement to make. And
let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you feel like he's, you know, and we've all heard about some of the negative press that he's gotten. There's been a couple of noted articles out on him,
which as well is about
I want to discuss that very shortly.
Do you think he's being pushed out?
No. He originally wanted to retire in 2017,
mm-hmm.
and when he realized the way they were reconfiguring the booth to be himself, Jeff Gordon, and Mike Joy, because they're moving Larry Mack out of the booth, he did not want Mike Joy to have to be up there and train two new people at the same time. So he stayed on essentially to help train Jeff Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
So
now my whole issue, Seth, and I know you and I are of like mind with this, right? Our friend Jenna Fryer, who writes for the Associated Press, she decided to, after he announced his retirement, right?
Before.
I guess it was before, right? Yeah, so she actually beat him to the punch. But she wrote a rather scathing kind of article that I think her headline was like, "Oh, Darrell Waltrip leaving, it's about time," right? And then she just used a lot of kind of really derogatory language to talk about her and, you know, Darrell and Mike Joy with their southern guffaws and you know, slap on the back old time stories. And I just thought it was very kind of demeaning on her part. But you know, Jennifer manages to stick her foot in her mouth at least once a year. But I felt it was like in really bad taste because Waltrip,
he's given back so much more to the
sport. He didn't deserve that.
I will say this. Granted, like I said, there's been some things that I've questioned privately with you guys. I can see certain things in private. I can't see writing an article like
that. Sure.
The main thing DW was upset about, and he said this to Clearby Lang on SiriusXM NASCAR, was that he was upset that Jen Fryer never reached out to him, mm-hmm. never reached out to Mike Joy, never asked them their opinion, just went along with that article. And he originally had planned at the end of the Sonoma race to say that he had a little bit more of breaking news and that that was his last race.
Yeah.
So
she stole his thunder.
Yeah. And again,
it feels like it got the announcement got rushed, not that he's getting rushed.
But if you sit there and you read social media, the social media sites, of there are literally hundreds of them that deal with NASCAR, and the fans get on and spout their opinions on everything in the sport. You're going to have a faction that likes, like Seth said, a faction that likes Darrell, a faction that doesn't like him. But not only is it Darrell, there are people that don't like Jeff Gordon, that people that don't like Mike Joy. Same thing in the NBC booth. There's a ton of people that don't like Steve Letarte. I mean, it goes on.
Guys, there's people that probably don't like us.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. But, you know, Darrell's a lifelong racer, and he's given so much back to the sport. He's a well-deserved Hall of Famer, three-time champion, 80-some victories. You know, he's got nothing. You know, he's done it all. And he can sit back and look at his career, both of his careers, with a lot of pride. And you know, I like Darrell. Some of the things I didn't like, the boogity 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 thing got old with me a little bit. But Darrell offered a lot of insight during the race about things that people would just shut up and listen to him sometimes. But if people, you know, every time, but people just get too carried away with all the other stuff that goes on. And hey, that's that, you know, each fan, they buy the cable subscription or buy the tickets or whatever, or tune in on TV. They have the right to do whatever they want. It's a shame. I do feel somewhat that he's not going out all together on his own terms. I feel that way because of this what's transpired in the last 6 weeks.
Oh, I agree. Everyone should just thank him for his contributions to the sport.
Absolutely.
And yeah. wish him well on the next, you know, chapter of his life. So but I digress. So Seth, do we have Xfinity truck racing?
We had the Xfinity Series racing. It was the first Dash for Cash race of the year. It was Justin Allgaier's race to lose and a
Christopher Bell's race to win, right?
And a sour engine gave the race to Christopher Bell and the $100,000 bonus. Although there was a rather interesting moment. Tyler Reddick in the first stage was leading, and the spotter told him the stage ended one lap too soon, giving the stage win to Justin Allgaier.
Yeah,
That guy had a talking to back at the shop.
And that's not totally unprecedented either, in that, you know, well, who was it, Seth? Mark Martin lost a race
Martin.
There. Yeah, because he was coming back to the white and thought it was the checker. And Mark Martin lost a.
I believe David Green ended up winning that race.
I remember that one. Yeah, that was crazy.
Several years ago, too. So it's not, like I said, it's not totally unprecedented. And also, it also happened at Daytona the same time Richard Petty won his 200th race. He raced Cale Yarborough back to the caution flag instead of the checkered flag. And Cale came to pit road.
And lost one position as a result.
Yeah, lost one position. That's right, exactly. He came to pit road thinking that they were racing back to the checker instead of they were actually racing back to the white and the yellow.
And one other thing I do want to mention, Harrison Burton, making his Xfinity debut, finished 10th. It's the first time since 1986 that a driver making their Xfinity debut at Bristol earned a top 10 finish.
Okay. That's pretty good.
Right. I really like Harrison Burton a ton. I think the kid's got a lot of potential, and I wish him well. I mean, that whole family, you know, between Ward and Jeff, those guys were and Gray, you've worked with Ward.
Yep. I've worked with Ward and Jeff.
Yeah, yeah. I love both those guys, you know. Sam
Boston, I watched Jeb grow up, so yeah. You know, and Jeb grew up literally before our eyes when Ward drove for us, and just like Ryan Blaney grew up before our eyes when his dad Dave drove for us at Bill Davis. So yeah, you know, it's been fun to watching those kids develop, you know, as they've come along, and of course, obviously they're all second generation drivers, and again, I wish them well and wish them a lot of success.
All right, so we're off to Richmond next, correct? Rich, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, do we want to make some picks for Richmond?
Yeah, y'all go first.
We haven't seen a Chevy win yet this year, so maybe I'll say Chase Elliott gets the first Chevy win of the year.
That's not a bad pick. Richard, who do you think?
I mean, you can't really look past Kyle Busch, can you? I mean, he's
no. You can't.
Or the Penske cars, they've been strong week in, week out.
I'm gonna tell you, you know, I'll go ahead and make man. I'm gonna throw since Richard likes Kyle, I'm gonna throw Clint Bowyer in the mix because Clint had a really good run going at Bristol and ran decent at Martinsville too. So I'm gonna say he's on the verge of picking up another short track win.
And while Richard is still deciding, it's a short track. He still hasn't won there. Truex.
Yeah, Sev, I tried that last week for Bristol. Didn't work for me either. So,
but I do want to say though, to your comment, Frank, that Chevy hasn't won yet this year. The last time Chevy went 9 straight races without a win was 1992, I believe.
Wow. You know, and I tell you something, they're starting to show some speed. You know, the Hendrick camp has been really good at qualifying the last couple of weeks. The RCR cars have qualified well, but the thing about it is they have found speed for qualifying, but they've yet to be able to sustain it in the race. And basically, you know, they've fallen off early.
Except for Texas, same way.
Well, they've fallen off early and often, and I think that's still part of the program they've got to work on to be able to sustain that speed, you know, further into the race. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, it's encouraging to see them at least, you know, qualifying well. So
and real quick note, speaking of qualifying well, the last time Hendrick swept the front row in back to back races, 1996.
Well, okay, all right,
all right.
Frank,
so
who you like?
Chase Elliott. I already picked Chase Elliott, didn't
Chase Elliott? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I don't know if I like him or not. I've not met the dude. He seemed like a pleasant guy.
Yeah, it ought to be a pretty competitive race. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, somebody wants to get in and break up the Penske Gibbs juggernaut that's going on right now. And I think probably, you know, maybe Bowyer's, you know, got a chance, but when you look at Kyle Busch and Joey Logano, you know, they're pretty strong at Richmond too. And you throw in Keselowski too. It's and Denny Hamlin, you know, it's hard to bet against those guys.
Yeah. And it's really weird that we're this deep in the season and Kevin Harvick hasn't won a race either.
Yep. Sure is. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about the big, you know, all we talked about last year was the big three, and the big three dominated the sport really for the you know, regular season at least. And you know, they haven't, other than Kyle, he's the big one. The other two principals in that haven't struck pay dirt yet.
Absolutely, yeah. So now, Richard, are you settled on Kyle Busch?
I am, yep.
Okay, all right, very good then. So let's talk about the IndyCar race. The IndyCars were down in Barber Motorsports Park, which is a beautiful racetrack in outside of Birmingham, Alabama. It's always one of my favorite races. And Richard, Our friend Takuma Sato won thing. He, the qualifying was so unpredictable. You know, all the practice sessions where everyone's saying, "Oh, Penske is sandbagging." When it comes to qualifying, you'll see, Willpower, Simon, Joseph, all up front. No, the Penske's were stymied in qualifying, which was weird. And then it looked like Hinchcliffe was a lock for the pole until that last qualifying session where the Ray Hall cars, came out of nowhere. The Ray Hall Letterman team took the front row. The last time Ray Hall Letterman took the front row was 2005, I believe.
There you go.
Yep. So they just kind of came out of nowhere, and then Takuma.
Dominating performance too by Sato.
Except for a couple of laps to go.
Whew. Except for one little Takuma called it a little heart attack moment. He was afraid he threw it away, but solid drive for Takuma. And I tell you, this guy just gets better with age, doesn't he, Richard? You worked with Takuma, and I think that he was just phenomenal on this day.
Oh, I mean, when you hear teams and drivers say, we found something in the setup. I mean, this weekend was a perfect example for the team there. To come out and dominate qualifying and to a greater extent be dominating the race with Takuma and Graham Rahal there driving away from guys like Scott Dixon and Sebastian Bourdais, was very, very, very impressive. And there was no real challenge. Nobody could really get close. They weren't playing a fuel mileage game. They weren't hammering the push to pass early on to build that gap. They were just driving solid. And, it was funny listening to Takuma post-race. He said that's the first time he's dominated a race in 20 years, probably since he was doing, Formula 3 back in Europe. And it genuinely was, they dominated that race. And I think, and you'll probably correct me if I'm wrong here, you look at the statistics now and he's won, is it two of the last five races with Portland at the back of last year?
Going to last year, two of the last five,
I did pick him as my surprise championship winner for the season. So who knows?
He's right there near the top of the points, yeah.
I think he's third at the moment, isn't he? But, he goes out there. I don't know where they are next, but they're at Long Beach this weekend,
aren't
they?
Long Beach this weekend, absolutely. Yeah.
He's won there.
He knows
his way around. If he goes out there and they qualify in the fast six again and, can have a solid result and, get a top three or whatever, and they do that two or three more times, then you've really got to put him in a breath as a championship contender. And I think I think it's good to mix it up a little bit, because the Penske domination and the Ganassi domination in the last few years is great for the guys there because they put a huge amount of work in. But I know that the team there is invested in engineering staff and invested in manpower there, and it's starting to pay off. So, good luck to him. And he's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet as well inside a race team. So good luck to him. Pleased with him.
And one of the things I thought was really impressive about his drive is the last 20 laps of the race, he gapped Dixon by just under 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And he kept it. He kept it at one. I mean, lap after lap when they crossed the line, he was 1.75 seconds ahead. And that margin stayed within a few one hundredths that whole 20 laps. You'd look until he had his little off track thing. But I mean, he would stay 1.78, 1.79, 1.6. And every lap, it didn't change. I mean, that was just being smooth and taking care of the car and not, like I said, I don't know how many push to passes he had at the end of the race. I'm sure he had some in his pocket in case he'd have needed them for a late race restart or whatnot. But I thought, and of course, what do you say about Dixon? Dixon finishes second for what, the sixth time?
Sixth time, yeah.
Yeah,
But you look at that, you look at that, you touched on something there, Greg. The way he dominated, not just in outright pace, but the consistency and the monotonous, pace. I mean, that demoralizes your opposition pretty quickly.
Yeah, because you look and you
can't do anything about it.
Right. He said he keeps that same distance from you. It's almost like he's toying with you.
you know, oh, to yeah. a degree. He knows he's got the car, and he's not going to overextend it to do it. And you're driving your ass off, and you can't mm-hmm. make inroads into the margin. Yeah, and I thought that was very impressive because I remarked several times during the races to the buddies and I watching the race, and I said, look at that gap. I mean, it's within a few hundredths of a second. Every lap, he maintains that margin. So, and you know, I mean, I wasn't looking at his overall lap times, but you know his overall lap times had to be the same, you know.
But you look at it, and I think that goes back a little bit to his upbringing in some of the European, you know, formula. And, you know, to get to Formula 1 like he did in the early 2000s, yeah, you need to be quick. But mm-hmm. there's so many other disciplines that you need, and, you know, that's what the team owners look for in the higher categories. You know, the ability to go out and do, you know, you'll be in testing and you'll turn around to a driver and say, okay, I want you to go out and do 15 laps in a row here and I want them to all be in this time interval. And they'll do it. Mm-hmm. Bang. You know, the good guy. And I'll tell you who the best was at that. The best guy I ever worked with for doing repetitive lap times was Anthony Davidson. I mean, that guy's driven more laps of Barcelona than anybody. And he could just, you know, hit his number over and over and over again. And I don't know enough about the way these kids are brought up racing in some of the lower series in the US, but I think you see some of the kids come through and they have great weekends and they have terrible mm-hmm. weekends. And, you know, and I know Takuma has had his off weekends, there's no doubt about it. But yeah. I some think guys when, just when he's that in the groove.
Yeah, some guys just have that internal rhythm. You know, that they're doing. And I tell you, you talk about that, some of the guys that I've seen do it. I've had to, back in early days, I'd go to Goodyear tire tests and mm-hmm. Go with guys, and you'd have guys like Terry Labonte and Tony Stewart. And those two guys could repeat the repeatability. They could go out and just turn lap after lap, and they could come in, they could actually come in and tell me, and I'd prepared the tires, they would come in and tell me what stagger I had in the tires. They could tell me if it was a quarter inch or five or three quarters of an inch. Yeah. And I mean, I thought, you know, and I'm saying, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's just remarkable the feel and the feel that they had.
Oh, yeah. You know, the good guys are on another level. You don't realize what they can tell you. I mean, there's another thing about Jackie Stewart driving a road car a few years ago. And he said, you know, it's when he was involved with his own team in the late 90s, and he turned around to his mechanics. It was at a sort of team building day. And he said, right, take a quarter of a PSI out of one of these tires and I'll tell you which one you've done it to. It's a quarter of a PSI. I mean, it's nothing. And he was right every single time because they just have such an intuitive nature. And a lot of people don't realize the level that these guys work at. It's until you see a really good guy, a really, really, you know, top driver, you don't really get what they do because the public don't see it. You know, they don't look at lap times or sector times or splits and, you know, tire wear and stuff like that. They just don't appreciate it. And it's a real shame because I think it does need to be brought forward more. But,
you know, the guys have a natural talent, natural physical talent, seat of the pants talent to hustle a race car. But you couple that with a real cerebral understanding of the car and everything else. I mean, it's like you said, the good guys are just unmatched.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's pretty special.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, like, so we're talking, we go from Coda last week, where we had the youngest winner ever, mm-hmm. right?
He went from first to last, didn't he?
Yeah, oh yeah. But look at the podium from Barber. You got three of the oldest guys out there, right? You know, mm-hmm. Takuma's the second oldest guy. The only older guy that Takuma is, tourniquet on. Dixon was the young guy on the podium. The other one was Bourdais. You know, Bourdais.
I thought, talking of Tony Kanaan, I thought he had a pretty rough weekend, didn't he?
Tony's had a rough couple years.
He was actually, bouncing off of every other car that got near him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. On a side note, Larry Foyt, who had been the team manager there, is actually going to step back, let somebody else assume that team manager role, to see if they can improve their fortunes. I'm not exactly sure who that is, because I don't have that article in front of me. But, you know, the Foyt team has – what was the last time they won a race? Oh, Takuma Sato.
Takuma Sato, yeah.
Long Beach 2013. They brought Tony on. They brought Matthias Laist in there. They are sadly lost some race weekends.
I think a lot of it is cubic dollars too. I don't think they have the money that the Ganassis and the Penske's and the Andretti's and them have too. So you know we see that in NASCAR all the time too. So basically, I think that they're deficient on that, and of course we all know that doesn't allow you to bring in some of the necessary people that you need to have to step your game up too. So I think that's one of the problems that AJ Foyt Racing has too.
Part of it, yeah, but at the same time, I know that the Hardy Steinbrenner team doesn't have quite the budget of the Penske's, and neither does the Ray Hall Letterman team. And those guys won the last two races.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that maybe Larry Foyt stepping back out of a controlling role to an administrative role and getting somebody else in there, it may be helpful for the team. I don't know. We'll have to see. But it's epic to see a guy like Tony Kanaan, who's probably got a lot of good years left in him. Yeah, I mean, the dude is the oldest guy in the series, but he is fit as you can imagine. You know, I think he can still drive top game. Just they're not the equipment that he needs to work for. So, but I digress. So,
well, I mean, two, you get the point too that there's the number of rides now is limited for a guy like with Tony with all these young guys coming in too. So, you know, that's another part of the conundrum he faces.
Certainly, yeah, too.
Yeah,
but Foyt team brought him on to help raise their team to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've just got to pull out all the stops there to see what sticks, I guess.
Let me ask you this before we move on to talk about Long Beach and we talk about other IndyCar news. What is the I know it's still early yet, but what are we still looking at entries for the 500? How many cars?
There are at least 33 confirmed,
mm-hmm.
Which means the field is full. And with another 3 to 4, so there will be as many.
It could be 35 to 40 cars there.
Well, I don't know if we're going to get to 40. I would say 36 is the high.
Yep.
But there's going to be 2 to 3 cars getting bumped.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and,
yeah. Well, that's.
And of course, you run the risk of bumping a series regular, which we saw last year when Hinchcliffe had to sit on the sidelines. So. Yeah,
but that's part of it. I mean, you know, that adds to the drama. And adds to the thing. I mean, I wish NASCAR had never gone to some of the things that they did years ago when they went to guaranteed spots and things like that. And I understand why they did it. They wanted to make sure their guy was in it. But I tell you what, it adds to the drama. It adds to the overall, to the overall specter of the race and how important it is. When you don't have these guaranteed spots in it, and you really got guys, you know, pulling out the stops to make the show. You know, we saw it years ago when I guess with Al Unser and several cars, the Penske cars didn't make the five. We got bumped out. When was that, Frank? That's been
1995.
Yeah, that's
the year after they won the thing.
Yeah, that was shocking.
Yeah, it was the year after they won. In dominant style with a Mercedes pushrod engine, mm-hmm. and then they could not get up to speed, and Al Unser Jr. and Emerson Fittipaldi missed the race, and then the following year was the split, so Penske wasn't back in Indy again until 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, so.
Just talk about who we like at Long Beach.
You know what? My gut feeling tells me Ryan Hunter-Reay wins at Long Beach. I don't know why. I just think that, but
seeing what you had for dinner.
Could be, yeah, could be. Mm. I actually haven't eaten today, so
definitely a gut feeling then.
Gray, who do you like for Long Beach?
It's been a wild and wacky season so far with guys. You know, of course, Newgarden had another good run, but I don't. I'm like you. I don't like. I think your pick there with Ryan's pretty good there, because he's done well on street courses before. I'm going to look and say, okay, Dixon. You know, I don't think Dixon, has he ever won Long Beach?
2015.
Okay.
He's won one in Long Beach. Yep, and it was a long time coming too. Yeah. That was one of his bucket list things.
Yep.
The other two Barber. Ever won are Barber and St. Pete.
Yeah. I'm gonna say Dixon, but watch somebody like Sebastian Bourdais come in and steal the thunder. I mean, that's how unpredictable IndyCar is right now.
We're 3 races in. We have 3 different winners, mm-hmm. 3 different teams.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
You know, Will. I mean, you know, goodness gracious, he's quick every week. But I mean, he just something befalls that team, him or that team. So it's kind of hard. And I still haven't seen Pagenaud put together a good strong run yet either. You know, of course,
I think he's in a bit of danger, isn't he, if he doesn't step up this season?
That's what they say. I don't know,
he hasn't been, I mean the last 2 seasons he's been pretty mediocre at best, hasn't he, after he won the championship.
Won the championship in 16, and then I think 17 he won 1 race. He went winless last year.
It's not bad, but it's not Penske good, you know.
Yeah, and let's talk about Takuma's teammate Graham Rahal. He had a good run going at Barber before mechanical issues got him. You know, too. They could have actually swept the front row I don't know if they swept front row in qualifying, but they could have conceivably had a 1-2 finish if had not been for some issues there. So Graham Rahal
Graham does great on the street courses. So Seth, you've been quiet. So who do you like for Long Beach?
Honestly, Felix Rosenquist.
Okay, yeah, he's been knocking on the door of breaking through. He really has. He hasn't had the luck, but he's been quick. So that's a good pick, Seth.
Who do you like, Frank?
Ryan Hunter Ray.
That's right. You already said that. I'm sorry. I've been George you all night long. Yeah. Okay.
guys, we got about 9 minutes left, and Seth, let's have a conversation about Richard's friend Jacques Villeneuve.
Yes, Jacques Villeneuve, the former F1 champion. Driver in multiple racing series. He's going to be a rookie once again in the NASCAR Whaling Euro Series, which starts back up this weekend. He's running full time. It's a 9 race schedule, and they start off in Valencia, Spain.
Seth, for our listeners out there, tell us what a NASCAR Euro car is. What it consists of. What kind of are they racing?
It's very similar to what they race up north in Canada in the Pinty series. General tires, they have the Chevrolet SS bodies, they have Ford Mustangs. I believe they also have Toyota Camrys, which is what, if I remember correctly, Alonde won the championship with
kind of like a super late model chassis, something like that.
Something along those lines. It's more comparable to what the
Pinty series
uses. Which the Pinty series is based off of the old Cascar bodies, if I remember correctly.
Okay. All right.
So now Villeneuve is in this series as a rookie.
Driving right. For Go Fast Racing,
it's kind of funny. But you talk about a guy who's won the Indy 500, the IndyCar Championship, and the Formula One World Championship. So yeah, now you're a rookie.
Yes.
And he's made several forays into stock car racing over the years. In fact, he made several starts with Bill Davis Racing when I was there,
and Team Penske,
and a Bill Davis truck, and we attempted a Daytona 500. Effort back in 2000. I forget what the year it was. I crewed the car, but I can't remember what year it was. It
might have been 2009 or 2010.
No, it was before that, because Bill Davis sold his operation in 2008. So it was.
Okay.
It was prior.
I'm thinking of when he.
Yeah, it's 2008.
I'm thinking when he,
We attempted a day. Like I said, we attempted a Daytona 500. And he ran several truck races with Bill Davis in the Toyota thing too. So, yeah, I mean he's done a little bit of everything. You know, of course we remember him most of his NASCAR stuff from where he drove. You know, Penske's. Nationwide cars at Montreal
and
was very quick and actually put on a really good show for the fans each time he ran up there.
Although he didn't make any friends on track.
No, he didn't make any friends, but he almost won a couple of races.
And I think he turned most of the fan base against him the one time he booted Danica from the lead at Road America.
Oh gosh, I remember that one. Yeah, yeah. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they got a Jacques Villeneuve to be how old did we say he was? 48? 48?
48 today.
48 today. It's his birthday. So, you know, good on him to keep racing. So,
Seth has some. Well, let me ask Seth. Seth's some other guys, well known names, participating in that that NASCAR Euro thing too. Who are they?
Yeah, Myatt Snyder. Last year's Truck Series Rookie of the Year will be competing full-time in the Elite 2 division. Former Cup champion Bobby Labonte will be competing as well. Jennifer Jo Cobb, a regular in the Truck Series, will be competing. And Alonde, who is the two-time defending champion, is returning as well.
Okay. Something bears watching later on as the year progresses.
And all of their races are streamed live on YouTube and on fanschoice.tv.
Okay.
All right. So, like I said, we just got about a couple minutes left. So, I want to mention that Richard, your friend, Fred Alonso, is driving his IndyCar around the Texas Motor Speedway. And they announced put out the picture of the livery, which is the papaya and blue car, which is kind of reminiscent of the old Mormon Meteor from the 40s. But it's a good-looking car. And so he ran some laps around Texas in a test. Richard, hear anything out of that, or other than that little tricky?
Yeah, the word he used was, trickier. He expects the IndyCars to be trickier. The guy's history, you know, he jumped into that car, 2 years ago, albeit a slightly different aero kit, and was pretty damn fast, wasn't he? So I don't think I think he's going to be there or thereabouts come, the month of May. But
do you think, last time, 500, he was with the Andretti team. Right.
Yeah, and I think this is the biggest thing for this week in Texas is probably going to be more actually beneficial to the team members working with him, because they're McLaren team members with Carlin support rather than Andretti mm-hmm. team members. So I think they're going to be the guys that potentially are going to gain more information, from this week than the driver himself. More on operational side of things.
Yeah, are they planning a run at Texas later in the year? Are they going to race? Are they going to?
No,
they're not.
No, they just ran at Texas to get him some overlaps ahead of the open test in Indianapolis and next month.
Because he will have to go through rookie orientation and all that sort of stuff. So he's probably he'd probably want to do that to get more laps back in it. But
my question to you, Richard, with we have a minute left, is. Do you feel like the McLaren effort is going to be do you think they're going to be right up there along line with the Penske's, the Ganassi's, the Andretti's?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. Yeah. All right.
McLaren, you know, despite all their troubles in recent years in Formula One and IndyCar is a different beast.
you know, and that's not detracting anything from IndyCar in any stretch of the imagination, but I think it would be far, you know, I think Alonso's more likely to win the Indy 500 than McLaren or to win a Formula One race in the next 3 years, in all fairness. You know, because the level that everybody's working at in Formula One is such a different level. And, you know, the money is so great that it's a lot, lot harder to make those incremental steps in Formula One than it is IndyCar. And so that's not being detrimental to IndyCar. It's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah, all I think, right. I mean, they'll have a few challenges for things that are new and different from them. But I think overall, from a technical standpoint, they'll be on top of their car. You know, there may be some other things that you know, they'll encounter just that are nuances to oval racing and nuances just to IndyCar, the pit stops, the things like that they'll have to work on. But as I say,
that's where I think they'll benefit this weekend, is from things like that. You know, I'm sure they've done pit stop practices.
And it's a good thing that they're doing that, you know, prior to the month of May, trying to, you know, shake out the cobwebs before they get there.
Out of the, out of the 200 laps, whatever the Indy 500 is, how many laps are you running in free air? You know, so from Alonso's perspective, you know, this week is pretty limited. You know, he needs to be around cars and in the pack and, you know, passing slower cars and seeing if he can take the high lines, you know, around corners and pass people on the outside and do all this sort of stuff. That's where he's going to, you know, he needs other cars around him. So this weekend is just familiarization and you know, get the team up to speed and make sure, you know, the seat's comfortable and the pedals are in the right position. And, you know, just silly little things that you wouldn't really consider are an issue, but in the real world, they are for these guys.
Right, but they'll save you time when you get to Indy.
Oh, yeah.
You won't have to back up and fix things when you can be working on, you know, getting speed out of your car.
Exactly.
All right, so on a bright note, Indianapolis 500 offers more practice than any other race in the world, and he'll be able to run with those other cars. So, but, guys, we are out of time. So I want to thank you, Gray, Richard, Seth, all three of you guys. I want to thank the Hoobazoo Radio Network. I want to thank iHeartRadio and Spreaker. And I want to thank all you folks that tune in and listen to us. And until next week, good night.
WHOOBAZOO.com. WHOOBAZOO.com. Enter website.